come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Hey there, and welcome back to KUCI FM in Irvine. We have Piper on the line, and before I introduce her, let's see if she can hear me. Are you there, Piper?
I am here. I can hear you a little fuzzy.
A little fuzzy. Can you make out anything I'm saying?
I can make out some of what you're saying, absolutely.
Enough to have a conversation. Well, let's try to have a conversation. And you can be long-winded as we do this, and I'll be short-winded.
Okay.
So first I want to introduce...
What's sort of interesting is that the music tracks are very clear, but the voice tracks are not.
So the music's clear, the voice isn't interesting. Okay, well, we have our engineer here now. Maybe we'll figure it out while you're on the air. In any case, Piper Kerman is a vice president at a Washington, D.C.-based communications firm that works with foundations and nonprofits. She's a graduate of Smith College, lives in Brooklyn with her husband, Larry Smith. And before we bring her on, I want to read a blurb by Elizabeth Gilbert that she gave for her book, Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison, a memoir published by Spiegel & Grau. Elizabeth said, I loved this book to a depth and degree that caught me by surprise. Of course, it's a compelling insider's account of life in a woman's federal prison, and of course, it's a behind-the-scenes look at America's war on drugs, and of course, it's a story rich with humor, pathos, and redemption. All of that was to be expected. What I did not expect from this memoir was the affection, compassion, and even reverence that Piper Kerman demonstrates for all the women she encountered while she was locked away in jail. That was the surprising twist, that behind the bars of women's prisons grow extraordinary friendships, ad hoc families, and delicate communities. In the end, this book is not just a tale of prisons, drugs, crime, or justice. It is, simply put, a beautiful told story about incredible women, and I will never forget it. I wanted to read that because I love that quote. It sums up how I felt about your book, Piper. I expected a gnarly prison memoir, and while aspects were indeed gnarly, the attitude of the author, your attitude, was replete with humor and grace. It was captivating, and I'd love you to talk about how the book came about.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. Certainly, Liz Gilbert's words really moved me when I first read them, and the fact that folks have taken the book in that way is exactly what every writer dreams of, to be able to tell a story that is, you know, compelling and interesting, but also surprising, and that reveals new things about the human condition, you know? Not to put too blunt a point onto it. The book came about following my spending 13 months in federal prison for a nonviolent drug offense that I committed when I was in my very early 20s. Fresh out of college, I got involved in a relationship with a woman who was involved in drug trafficking, and I followed her around the world. And many, many years after that relationship had ended, that came back to bite me on the butt, as it were. After serving that year in prison, I came home, you know, to a much more comfortable life than most folks who leave prison do. And, you know, we do incarcerate more people in this country than any other country in the world. When I did come home, what was interesting, you know, I was a true outlier among my friends. Among my friends, my family, most people knew absolutely no one who had ever set foot in a prison or a jail. Even though we do incarcerate so very many people, there are sort of two Americas going on here. And what I found when I did come home was that people wanted to hear about my experience in as much detail as I was willing to share. And people would just sit on, you know, the bar stool or the chair next to me and say, and then what happened, and then what happened, and then what happened. And that was sort of the beginnings of thinking about writing about the experience. I am a first-time writer. This is my first book. In fact, this is the first thing I've ever published. So that was not necessarily a simple undertaking, but it was one that I was definitely willing to do. And I think the reason that I was really compelled to write the book was because I felt that my own experience had been so different from what I had anticipated and so different from what people expected would have transpired behind bars. And I really wanted to write about that.
Hmm. I'm talking with Piper Kerman. Her book is Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison, a memoir published by Spiegel and Grau. I'm curious, you know, you knew for 5 years that you were going to go to prison, so there was 5 years of waiting.
Yep.
How did you wait for 5 years to go to prison? I mean, did you ever think of, like, going to Mexico or doing something?
It was an unusual delay that transpired. You know, basically I was indicted in 1998, but I didn't walk into prison gates until 2004. If you look at my case is a sort of a convoluted one, the actual legal case. But if you look at it, it's a conspiracy case, as many, many, drug cases are in this country. And at the top of the indictment is a West African drug kingpin, and at the bottom of the indictment is me. And what was unexpected was that the kingpin was taken into custody in Britain on a warrant on this indictment and fought extradition successfully for, you know, over the course of many years, was released, and then eventually the U.S. government sort of turned back to cases like mine and sent us off to prison. But there was never any question that prison was going to happen. That was a challenging almost 6 years to sort of contend with that fate and to sort of be resolved to go on with life anyway. And the truth of the matter is that when I did walk into prison gates, I was a lot more mature, certainly far, far, far mature than when I actually committed the offense, you know, 11 years prior, and far more mature than when I had been indicted, because I'd been thinking about the consequences of my actions and thinking about, you know, the price that I would have to pay for a long time. So on a lot of levels, that day that I self-surrendered in February of 2004, I was certainly not happy to be going to prison, but I was feeling like this would be the light at the end of the tunnel, actually, serving the sentence itself.
Yeah, interesting. This would be a great time for you to read to us, if you would, and maybe read a longer section because of our
sure,
what's going on here. It'd be great to just hear you.
Okay. I thought I might read a section from early in the book, and definitely early in the
views and opinions expressed on this
being
program
a prisoner,
do not necessarily
maybe,
represent those.
Give folks a little bit of a sense of what it's like to be new in prison, what's called a new fish. So, with no further ado, in a prison setting. So I served most of my time, but not all of my time, in a facility, a federal facility, which is in Danbury, Connecticut. And it's called FCI Danbury, Federal Correctional Institute for women, and only women, fortunately, up there in Danbury, not so far from New York, where I live now. So what you find is that there's very little privacy in prison, as you would probably expect. And there are these sort of shared zones, these social zones, things like television rooms or the dining hall. So I'll tell you a little bit about the dining hall starting out. A constant presence in the dining hall was my new friend Nina's former bunkie Pop, the imposing 50-ish wife of a Russian gangster who ruled the kitchen with an iron fist. One evening, I was sitting with Nina as the dinner hour was drawing to a close, when Pop sat down with us, clad in her customized burgundy kitchen smock, adorned with Pop over the heart in white yarn, a la Laverne and Shirley. I, knowing less than nothing, began maligning the food. It didn't occur to me at that point that anyone would put any pride into their prison job, but Pop did. When I made a joke about a hunger strike, that was it. Pop fixed me with a ferocious glare and a pointed finger. "Listen, honey, I know you just got here, so I know that you don't understand what's what. I'm going to tell you this once. There's something here called inciting a riot, and that kind of shit you're talking about, hunger strikes, that kind of shit, that's inciting a riot. You can get in big trouble for that. They will lock your ass up in solitary in a heartbeat. Now, me, I don't care. But you don't know these people, honey. The wrong one hears you saying that shit, she goes and tells the correctional officer, you're going to be shocked how quickly the lieutenant is coming to lock your ass up. So take a tip from me and watch what you say." And with that, she left. Nina looked at me, silently telegraphing, "You asshole." From then on, I stayed out of Pop's path, ducking my head to avoid her eyes on the chow line. February is Black History Month, and someone had festooned the dining hall with posters of Martin Luther King Jr., George Washington Carver, and Rosa Parks. "They didn't put shit up for Columbus Day," groused a woman named Lombardi behind me in line. Was she really objecting to Dr. King? I kept my mouth shut. The minimum security camp at Danbury housed approximately 200 women at any given time, although sometimes it climbed to a nightmarishly cramped 250. About half were Latino, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Colombian, about 24% white, 24% African American or Jamaican, and then a very random smattering. One Indian American, a couple of Middle Eastern women, a couple of Native Americans, one tiny Chinese woman in her 60s. I always wondered how it felt to be there if you lacked a tribe. It was all so very West Side Story. Stick to your own kind, Maria. The racialism was unabashed. The three main dorms in the camp had organizing principles allegedly instituted by the staff, who assigned housing. A dorm was known as the suburbs. B dorm was dubbed the ghetto. And C dorm was Spanish Harlem. The upstairs rooms, where all new people went first, were a very strange mix. The most physically ill women in the camp, or pregnant women, like the one I had seen when I first arrived, occupied the bottom bunks in the rooms. The top bunks were full of newbies, like me, or behavior problems, of which there was never a shortage. Room 6, where I lived, was serving as a sick ward rather than a punishment room. I was lucky. At night, I would lie in the dark in my bunk over a snoring Polish woman, listening to the thrum of another roommate's breathing apparatus and gazing past the sleeping top bunk shapes out the windows, which were level with my bunk. When there was a moon, I could see the tops of fir trees and the white hills of the far valley. I spent as many hours as I could standing out in the cold, staring to the east over an enormous Connecticut valley. The camp sat perched atop one of the highest hills in the area, and you could see rolling hills and farms and clusters of towns for miles over the giant basin of the valley below. I saw the sunrise every day in February. I braved the rickety, icy stairs that led down to a fieldhouse gym and the camp's frozen track, where I'd crunch around bundled in my ugly brown coat and itchy army green hat, muffler, and mittens before heading into the cold gym to lift weights, almost always mercifully alone. I wrote letters and read books, but time was a beast, a big, indolent, immovable beast that wasn't interested in my efforts at hastening it in any direction. Some days I barely spoke, keeping my eyes open and mouth shut. I was afraid less of physical violence, I hadn't seen any evidence of it, than of getting cursed out publicly for screwing up, either breaking a prison rule or a prisoner's rule. Be in the wrong place at the wrong time, sit in someone's chosen seat, intrude where you were not wanted, ask the wrong question, and you'd get called out and bawled out in a hurry, either by a terrifying prison guard or by a terrifying convict, sometimes in Spanish. Except to pester Nina with questions and to theorize and trade notes with my fellow newbies about what was what, I kept to myself. But my fellow prisoners were in fact looking out for me. Wormtown Rose Marie brought me her copy of the Wall Street Journal every day and checked on how I was. And Yoga Janet would make a point of sitting with me at meals, and we would chat about the Himalayas and New York and politics. She was appalled when a subscription to The New Yorker showed up for me at mail call. "You might as well read the Weekly Standard," she said with disgust. One commissary day, shopping was twice a week in the afternoon, half the camp on Monday, the other half on Tuesday. Nina appeared in the door of room six. Still without money in my prison account, I was washing with loaned soap and was deeply envious of the other prisoners' weekly shopping excursions. "Hey, Piper, how about a root beer float?" said Nina. "What?" I was dumbfounded and hungry. Dinner had been roast beef with an eerie, metallic green cast. I had eaten rice and cucumbers. "I'm going to get ice cream at commissary, and we can make root beer floats." My heart soared and then crashed. "I can't shop, Nina. My account didn't clear yet." "Would you shut up? Come on." You could buy a pint of cheap ice cream at the commissary, vanilla, chocolate, or strawberry. You had to eat it right away because, of course, there was no freezer, just a big ice dispenser for prisoners. Woe to the inmate who stuck a pint into the ice machine and got caught by another inmate. You would get yelled at for being disgustingly unsanitary. Like many things, it just was not done. Nina bought vanilla ice cream and two cans of root beer. My mouth was watering as she prepared our floats in plastic coffee mugs, the foam a luscious rich brown. She handed me one, and I sipped, wearing a foam mustache. It was the best thing I had tasted since I got to prison. I felt tears pricking behind my eyes. I was so happy. Thank you, Nina. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, Piper. You were listening to Piper Kerman read from her new book, Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison, a memoir. So much to talk about, and what I want to also tell our listeners is that when your book comes out in paperback in March, we're going to do a Q&A on the blog so that all the stuff we didn't get to today and more will be on the penonfire.blogspot.com blog, so you can hear more there about the book. But in the time we have remaining, I'm curious how you reconstructed your time there in prison. Did you take notes while you were there? Did you keep a journal, or do you just have a fantastic memory?
Very good question. I have never been a daily journal keeper in my life. I did keep an occasional journal while I was actually incarcerated. I only wrote in that journal when I was really upset about something I found when I went back and read it. It was primarily a place to really put down my thoughts when I was really agitated, which was, you know, instructive and helpful for certain key parts of the book. But the fundamental thing that I think was important in terms of reconstructing the experience was letters. So I was incredibly blessed because I received hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters from friends, from family members, and sometimes even from strangers, friends of friends, who had heard about the situation and were kind enough to write me. And, of course, I wrote them all back. And I kept every single letter I received in prison, which is an interesting perspective on the outside world, certainly. But I was very fortunate because many of my friends kept the letters that I wrote to them from prison. And when I did decide to write the book in earnest after I came home, most of my friends photocopied those letters and sent them to me, and I put them together in a cron, in a binder, a big fat binder. And they serve as a really interesting chronology and quite detailed catalog of the experience and of what I was thinking and feeling at various times, and really interestingly sort of the things that I wanted other people to know about what the experience was like, what I was going through. So there was, in an interesting way, perhaps even an editorial hand there in terms of what a person chooses to tell the outside world about their prison experience right there in those letters. So I'm incredibly grateful to my friends for sharing those back with me. They were probably the single most useful and valuable thing. I also have a lot of paperwork and other sort of primary document type stuff that I kept that also went into that sort of primary primary binder, which was my Bible while I was writing.
I wanted to comment on the title and the cover, which I do often on this show, because I think you can judge a book by its cover. And I love the cover to your book, and I love the title. Did you know it was going to be this? I mean, was that your original title? And then the cover, did you have any input on that?
You know, it's very interesting. That is the title. That was the title that went out with the book proposal, and it was always the title, you know, Orange is the New Black, which, you know, sounds perhaps a little jovial, but
it fits the book.
It's an indicator that the book deals with a really difficult subject with humor. That's certainly one of the most critical and crucial survival tools for getting through a prison experience, is having a sense of humor. I think that any prisoner, no matter how brutal their experience might have been behind bars, would probably agree. The other thing about the title is that it definitely is a reference to the fact that women are the fastest growing segment of the prison population in this country, and that is largely due to drug laws. So it definitely has a slightly more serious undertone, but I wanted people to know that this is a memoir that is going to deliver not only some insight into an unusual setting and, you know, a difficult setting, but also, you know, some of the humor that would help anyone survive that kind of an experience. The cover, you know, just, you know, Spiegel & Grau did a great job. So, you know, I'm very, very lucky with the cover. I can't claim to be any kind of a designer, but I was thrilled when we arrived at this cover.
Yeah, it's beautiful, actually. I mean, it's sort of, you know, sometimes there are books I just want, whether I read them or not, because the cover. I read your book and loved it, but just the cover alone would be enough reason to buy the book and to keep it on your shelf, almost face out. Just gorgeous. Any sort of last words for the listeners who are writing a memoir?
Well, you know, I think that the willingness to confront some of the biggest mistakes that you've ever made in the written word, and the willingness to sort of put your story out there, is really, really important and sheds a lot of light on what other people are going through as well. I mean, I think one of the experiences of incarceration is certainly moments of feeling incredibly, incredibly alone. And one of the things that you learn, or that I learned, by that experience is that, you know, we're really not alone. And there's this old trope in prison of, you know, you walk in alone and you leave alone, sort of trying to hammer home that idea of solitary survival. But I really found the opposite to be true. I found that survival was completely dependent on the strength of my relationships with people on the outside world who were pulling for me, and also on my ability to form really strong relationships with certain people on the inside. And I think the ability or the willingness of folks who have difficult experiences and personal failures, I mean, my book is in a lot of ways about personal failure, you know, choosing to write a book about your biggest screw-up ever and the consequences that you paid for it, is important, you know? It's not just stories of victory that that help us understand the world.
Well, I loved it, and I'm so glad we were able to talk. And the first half of the show did not go well, so this half worked a little better. So thank you so much, and I'll look forward to writing back and forth with you as your paperback nears publication in the new year.
Great. Thank you so much, Barbara. Yeah. Thanks for all your thoughtful questions.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
That was Piper Kerman. Her new book is Orange is the New Black, published by Spiegel & Grell. Her website is piperkerman.com, P-I-P-E-R-K-E-R-M-A-N. I wanted to talk about the work she's doing for prison reform, and we didn't get to that. And there's so much more. As I said, there will be we'll do a Q&A on the blog in March when her paperback comes out. And you can find that by going to penonfire.com and clicking on blog. If you want to know more about the show, you can send me an email through the site as well, and I'll get you on the mailing list. You can follow me on Twitter or Facebook, and I usually post who's coming on and what's going on with the show. At that, I'm going to leave you. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I do want to also say Myra Coleman is so gracious and wonderful, and it didn't work out the first half hour with her, but I'm going to come in here next week probably and pre-record a show. We might get her for an hour, actually, and I will schedule that for broadcast perhaps at the end of December, beginning of January, something like that, so that you can listen and perhaps love her as much as I do, if you don't already. Anyway, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. This is KUCI FM in Irvine, and thank you for listening. I hope your season's going well. Take a deep breath, and don't forget your writing.